This is the Experience Points Podcast, episode number 104 for the week of November 17th, 2010.
Welcome back to the Experience Points Podcast. I'm George Albor.
My name's Scott Juster.
And we are the co-creators of experiencepoints.blogspot.com, a site dedicated to the serious but not humorless analysis of video games and culture. And today we are talking about a Supreme Court case that many of you may have heard about. It's called Arnold Schwarzenegger, which is, who is our governor, we should say, our proud governor, governator, as some call him. Versus the Entertainment Merchants Association, which is a Supreme Court case that is essentially discussing whether or not violent video games should be banned in California.
The law is actually banning the sale of violent video games to minors.
Yeah, that's right, right. The lawyer in the case's name is Mr. Morzini, and he makes a couple of arguments that rely upon what's called the Miller test. The aspect of the Miller test that's important in this case is that the work, taken as a whole, must lack serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific value. And so going from that aspect of the Miller test, we're actually branching off from an article today by Jason Schreier from Game Life on Wired called Bloody Redemption in Nine Violent Video Games, in which he mentions, well, you know, here are nine violent video games that we can all attest to are very violent, but maybe they have some value in them, either, you know, literary, political, whatever. So before we get into that, let's talk a little bit about the Supreme Court case, because I think it's actually, it's pretty important.
Yeah, I mean, it's anytime you're trying to expand what the First Amendment does or doesn't protect, it's kind of a big deal.
Yeah, and especially to us, because we live in California.
That's right. But we're not minors, so, you know, all those kids can just, you know,
screw it. Well, but see, that's the thing is, there's the actual fear that the Merchants Association has is that game creators, if they're not going to be able to sell their games to minors, if they're not going to be able to even know really well what is going into their games that would or would not be a bannable offense, then they're just going to steer clear of that level of violence anyway.
Yeah, I mean, and you know, they call it the chilling effect, basically. You know, it will prevent people from taking chances, whether artistic or business, when they're not quite sure how things are going to be regulated and if chunks of their market, again, both business and artistic, are going to be cut out of it.
Exactly. And a lot of people mention Walmart because, you know, Walmart is one of the biggest distributors of retail games. And there's a legitimate fear that, you know, Walmart's just not going to sell these games. If they're, you know, not allowed to sell them to minors, then Walmart's just not going to do it. They're a family-friendly store. And so all of a sudden, it's a huge economic decision when you have to decide whether or not to make a violent video game. Mm-hmm. Some of the justices, and for those who haven't read the proceedings, I highly recommend it because it's actually hilarious. The Supreme Court justices are incredibly critical of the plaintiff. And they've
of
just
everybody,
really, cut into
really. Like they ask pointed questions.
Yeah, they're like a pack of wolves. It's terrifying. I could not imagine being a lawyer in front of the Supreme Court. But one of their issues is with the vagaries of the law. But I want to talk in particular about why the case is being brought to the Supreme Court in the first place. And I think the fact that the Supreme Court is even willing to hear the case is telling of how serious of an issue this is to a lot of people. Mr. Morazzini specifically says that there are two intentions for the law. The first is that it enables parents to better protect their kids. And this is a case where he says specifically that, you know, and he cites, which is true, parents have the right to raise their kids as they see fit. And that video games being sold to minors undermines the ability for parents to do that. The second thing is that it helps protect kids who don't actually have parents or their parents aren't around enough to help regulate their consumption of media. And both of them, in my opinion, I think are very legitimate concerns. You know, I don't necessarily think that there are enough well-understood protections that parents can use or help understand, you know, how their kids play games and what sort of games their kids play.
I think there might be it's not that there isn't enough. It's that they're not publicized well enough. I mean, I'm always quite amused to read the ESRB warnings on the back because they get into really amusing detail about what's in the game. Like, oh, here's tobacco use. Here are adult situations, but not sexual situations, just adult situations. I mean, like, so there's plenty of
which is what exactly? Like paying for your commuter fare?
Yeah, this is just your mortgage payments. Kids don't want to know anything about that. But I mean, the bigger problem is that I think the ESRB is not as well known as the MPAA. And, you know, part of that is maybe because the MPAA has been around for many decades and the ESRB is just, you know, been around for roughly more than 15 years now. So maybe 17 years or so. And there's no quick offhand reference for parents. You know, they'd have to go to the ESRB's website or something like that.
Yeah. There's a website that helps parents do that. Do you know what it's called?
There was a website called What They Play.
Yeah, that's what I'm thinking.
But I'm not sure if What They Play is still... I'm not sure if it still exists in the form that we knew it in. I don't know for sure, but there were some editorial turnovers. But, I mean... Again, I don't think most people are as savvy about what it means to rate a game M versus what it means to rate a movie R. And that's not the rating system's fault. It's publicizing the rating system. It's not that it doesn't work. It's just that people are not or cannot use it for one of various reasons.
I guess, well, I would disagree a little bit. I think the ESRB suffers from the same thing that the MPAA suffers from. And that is they have a deficit of accountability, right? No one knows who is judging them. So yeah, the ESRB could say, I want to advertise our rating system better to parents, which might be a good idea, but we don't really know who is doing the rating, right? We don't really know what sort of criteria.
Yeah, but I mean, we have a consensus that the ratings are okay. No one's ever taken a large issue with the ESRB and like, why did you rate this game an E when this guy's ripping a head off or something like that? Yeah. I mean, the mystery, I feel like, is a separate issue.
I think there's something important to say for where that information is coming from. And I guess you could say, well, parents will just trust the ESRB. But I don't think that they've built up the trust yet that the MPAA has built with people. And not to say that, because in my opinion, the MPAA is terribly flawed and really problematic. And so the ESRB is essentially built upon the same mechanisms that the MPAA are. So for a long-term solution, I don't see anything coming out of the ESRB that would be very good.
Well, I mean, I don't really know the numbers on the MPAA, like how often kids can sneak into theaters versus what parents know, but I feel like parents have a pretty good idea of what the difference is between an R-rated movie and a PG-rated movie.
I guess, but there's huge differences.
There are, but I mean, there are certain minimum differences. Like, there will be, you know, buckets of blood in an R-rated movie. In a PG movie, you just can't have that much blood in there. You know that there's not going to be any F-bombs in a PG movie.
Yeah. This is actually one of the other things I'm sympathetic to from Mr. Morazzini's argument, which is, well, I should say, someone criticized him. I believe it was Justice Kennedy said that, you know, we have a social consensus about what obscenity is in terms of sexuality, for example. Mm-hmm. We know when something is just terribly obscene and not appropriate to be sold, and we can regulate it that way. There has been past judicial cases, and there has been a lot of conversation about it within communities and within society as a whole over the past 100 years or so. And we don't have that social consensus for what violence looks like in an interactive medium. And so the lawyer said that the intent of the California law is exactly to start establishing what a social consensus will look like for something like violent video games. And I'm sympathetic to that idea because, you know, video games are relatively new and they are interactive. And there's an implicit statement in all of this that says, in fact, it's not implicit, it's very explicit, that games uniquely affect people who play them, and in particular children, which is kind of what we argue here on HB, right? I mean, video games are fantastic because they're interactive for very specific reasons.
Yeah, but I mean, I think there's a difference between saying something... I mean, every medium is unique. Like, movies affect people in a unique way. Art, painting affects people in a unique way.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure just because something works in a certain way it needs to have a different set of standards for in comparison to other mediums, like especially when you're talking about obscenity.
Yeah.
I think it starts getting a little tricky.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And the studies that Morzini mentions in his briefings are not incredibly accurate. There's not a lot of studies about, you know, there's not a strong correlation between playing violent video games and making someone into a bad person.
Yeah, versus maybe, you know, heavy metal music versus, you know, watching A Clockwork Orange. I mean, I could see all of those having similar neurological effects on folks, but that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, we need to treat video games differently just because it affects those neurological changes in a different way.
Yeah, that's true. I completely agree. My point is just that I think it's telling that video games are in a place in our society right now where we're still trying to figure out how we relate to them in a moral way.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. And it's something that I wish was discussed a little bit more rather than legislated. I'm not sure trying to make a serious change to the Constitution is the right venue to have a discussion.
Yeah. Well, I think the justices would agree.
Yeah, I mean, they seemed a little testy in some of the back and forth that they had. But, I mean, they asked some good questions.
Yeah. At one point, Justice Alito said, I think what Justice Scalia wants to know is what James Madison thought about video games. Did he enjoy them?
You know, and there's a whole group of people that will look for the original intent. You know, what would the Founding Fathers have said about this sort of thing? Which is just, you know, it's absurd in a way, but it's also nice because you're trying to apply actual legal strategies to something that in the past has not been taken very seriously.
Yeah. Well, you're a historian. You know a lot about the Founding Fathers. What do you think? Do you think
I've been studying about the Founding Fathers quite a bit recently, actually, in the early Republic.
Would they get a kick out of Fallout 3, do you think?
Well, they'd probably... it depends. Can you make your character look like a revolutionary or a redcoat?
Yeah, maybe. Probably. There's trench coats.
they probably would like to take a few pot shots on some of the redcoats if you could mod your character in that way.
Well, let's get to the Jason Schreier article, which, again, addresses whether or not there are serious literary, artistic, political, or scientific values in these incredibly violent games.
Yeah, and some of them are more tongue-in-cheek than others, and some of them, I think, are surprisingly insightful, and maybe even unexpectedly so.
Well, the first one he mentions is Fallout 3, which is a very violent video game. In fact, there's a perk that makes it more violent, which
I think... Yeah, I was thinking about that when I read this.
Yeah, which is pretty hilarious. He says that Fallout 3 actually tells a story of war. It affects us as people. We're seeing a post-apocalyptic Washington, D.C. There's a political message in Fallout 3. I think that's absolutely true. So, yeah, it's a valuable game, I would say.
And I also think there's something to be said for the ability to play it non-violently.
Yeah.
I think there's a cultural commentary.
It's very, very hard.
That's right, and I think that's a cultural commentary that how hard it is to get something done without violence in that society, and you know you start thinking about your own when you're in that kind of situation. I remember Gerard Delaney tried to play, I think it was Morrowind. He tried to play it as a complete pacifist, and it was just the hardest because to get even the most minor things done, he had to negotiate with everybody and run away from battles and stuff. And so he just spent a whole bunch of his time retreating and negotiating.
Yeah, that's so tedious. Someone just beat Fallout 3 New Vegas non-violently.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that was a complete pain in the ass to do, but maybe rewarding. So maybe that's the message of it. The next entry on the list was Silent Hill 2. And, well, I mean, I haven't had that much experience with the Silent Hill franchise, but if something like Halloween or Nightmare on Elm Street is okay, I think Silent Hill should be okay too. What do you think?
Oh man, Silent Hill 2 is terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. Although, yeah, you're right. I think, you know, Halloween is pretty scary too. But Pyramid Head has just, wow, a thing of nightmares.
What kind of violence does Pyramid Head do?
Well, there's the craziest thing that he does, in my opinion, is engage in what looks like terribly painful and violent sexual acts with other zombies. God. So, I mean, there's a scene in which you're hiding in a closet and you're watching Pyramid Head. Look, it's pretty much like he's raping these people. Jeez. Violent rape of a zombie corpse. That's very... Now, that is adult content. That's messed up. If I've ever seen it.
What's the redeeming value of it? What's the trick?
You mean from the raping scene? I'm not sure there is any. Well,
I mean, there always has to be something, even if you're trying to explore, like, the depths to which people are voyeuristic.
Yeah,
I think Silent Hill is about kind of voyeurism in many ways.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I mean, the main character of Silent Hill 2, spoiler alert for Silent Hill 2, but a lot of these things are just figments of his imagination in which his own psychoses are becoming realized in these horrific forms. And so when you see someone like Pyramid Head, who maybe, I don't know, maybe it represents his ego or something like this, taking violent sexual acts against these zombie women, this might represent, you know, some of his feelings towards women in his past and et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Which is valuable, but you have to get that out of the game, right?
And it could take a little work.
Yeah, it does. You have to finish the game. That's the thing, too, is getting value out of some of these violent video games, you know, you gotta put in some effort.
True.
Next, we have Bully, which is the sandbox kind of private school Grand Theft Auto style video game.
Yeah, Rockstar developed.
Yeah, which I played Bully for a little bit and wasn't all that into it, but I could absolutely see this as very redeeming. It's interesting because the law in California is specifically targeting minors, and Bully is specifically about a minor doing very bad things in a school environment. This is probably the most realistic form of violence that a kid could interact with.
I feel like Bully is one of those cases where people might not want to admit how much of the violence hits home. I mean, not that kids are actually beating each other up with bats, but you know what? Sometimes they do. And sometimes childhood can be ugly, and there is bullying going on, and kids do horrible things to each other. Something like that is important to see every once in a while, because you have to be reminded that childhood isn't completely innocent.
It's interesting because the California law specifically addresses children as unique creatures, essentially. And, you know, this is enshrined by the laws that we've signed on to across the nation, that children are special. But Bully is interesting because it shows that even violence of a very large scale violence, some of the things that happen in Bully, particularly, around homosexual behavior and how it depicts that in private school, those are very adult themes that kids actually deal with, you know?
Yeah.
So Bully is interesting because it's a game that I think kids should play, you know, and adults should play too, because you're kind of seeing how these interactions happen in a confined system, you know, and you can kind of deal with it and try to understand it in a way that you don't get to on the fucking playground.
Yeah, and, you know, you have the luxury of interacting with a much simpler system than you have out on the real playground, which is nice to either, you know, act as a trial run or to act as kind of a cautionary tale as to what happens when things can go too far.
Exactly, because that's the thing is, you know, adult content defines whether or not a mature game is mature or whether or not it's for everyone, right? But there are things that I would say are very adult that kids must deal with, even though they're children. Yeah. And having those adult content, like that adult content, should be in games for kids.
Yeah. Well, speaking of little kids, the next entry on the list of violent games that are redeeming is everyone's favorite, BioShock. And, I mean, BioShock is like the poster child for artistic games at the moment.
Yeah, it's Little Mermaid. Little Mermaid means Ayn Rand. Absolutely.
But it's also, I was just playing the demo of BioShock again the other day just to kind of get a taste of it. And I forget every once in a while how gruesome that game is. Not necessarily actively, but just walking around in the environment. It's just violent. There's gross stuff everywhere.
There's that image of the crazy splicer over the little baby, and there's like a gun instead of the baby, and you know, you kind of have to ask yourself, what happened to that baby? How come there aren't any children other than little sisters in this world?
I mean, I think the violence in BioShock is artistically redeeming. I mean, you learn so much about what happened in that environment just by how disgusting everything is. The artistry that went behind the blood trails leading to knocked over furniture, which then leads to a corpse. You know exactly how that person died. And, I mean, even overall, I mean, philosophically, they comment on the violence in the game. I mean, this is what happens when you have a completely objectivist society.
Yeah, yeah, it's great because it's a political commentary.
But, I mean, it's also something that I find it also very pessimistic in a way, because the only way to deal with that ultimately violent society, you know, an objectivist society is its logical conclusion is just sheer violence. The only way to battle that is by more violence in the game, which I also think is a political and artistic statement that is not a very happy one.
Do you think that miners should be able to play Bioshock? I mean, not just being able to, but I mean, do you think that miners in particular would get something valuable from it? And yes, I'm using the universal miner as a class.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think if there's proper guidance, like I would think Bioshock would be a really nice companion piece to a lot of the books kids start getting exposed to in high school about what a society's role is and what an individual's role is in the society. You know, if you're going to force kids to read things like Atlas Shrugged or The Fountainhead or something like that, or even more general things like The Great Gatsby, like what does it mean to have capitalism? What is the end result of it? Is there a difference between people that are dreaming and people that are actually doing something in the society?
Yeah.
But I mean, there has to be framing. Like I worry about without framing, it's just a bunch of, you know, shooting dudes.
Yeah, I would totally agree. Well, speaking of framing, you know, a lot of kids in middle school start getting their education about Greek culture and mythology. So maybe playing some God of War, which is the next on the list, would be an appropriate game for children.
Well, I mean, this is the most complicated one because this is where the interaction comes into play. But I mean, the easiest way to argue it is that if you actually go back and read the Greek myths, man, that shit is violent.
Oh, hell yeah, it is.
I mean, there is just disgusting stuff happening at all times and to all people in all ways.
Yeah, amputations, there's disfigurements.
I mean, God of War is actually relatively tame when you think of, like, all the animal sex and stuff that happens in Greek myths. But, I mean, like, so the argument that they put up in the article is that it's actually very true to the heritage, that there was some pretty pulpy stuff in the original Greek myths, which I completely agree with.
Well, then maybe we should ban Greek myths.
They're pagans anyway. So speaking of things that are hopefully myths, we have Left 4 Dead 2 as the next entry on the list. And I don't know, George, you have a lot of experience with Left 4 Dead 2.
Yes.
Pretty violent.
Oh, absolutely, yeah. The interesting thing is that I feel like zombies are a special case, and maybe we've come to recognize it, but we see zombies as inhuman, right? So when we do violent things against them, is it really that violent, I ask you? I don't know. That's just my thoughts on the violence of Left 4 Dead. In terms of its redeeming value, I think there's something to say for the experiences you have with other players. So, you know, I don't think it necessarily teaches you a lot about politics, Left 4 Dead. Well, actually, you know what? That's not true. Left 4 Dead 2 makes political commentary about how the United States, in particular, and certainly alluding to Hurricane Katrina, deals with natural disasters. Yeah. And the way that the military-industrial complex is kind of used inappropriately in those circumstances. I think that's really interesting, Left 4 Dead 2 does. And it doesn't do it in your face, but it's certainly there. I think even just watching the trailer for Left 4 Dead 2 alludes to that material, that content, and you just, you know, it's hard to miss. Even if a minor were playing it themselves. I think Left 4 Dead 2 is an experience that you don't necessarily need to have framed. You know, it'd be nice if you're completely unaware about DARPA, then yeah, but...
Does the violence in the actual game inform the military stuff that's going on around you? Is there a sense that you have to resort to this because there should be someone helping you?
You certainly see in the safe houses, people have scrawlings about, you know, let's meet up, or the military isn't doing anything, they're shooting people, that kind of stuff. So I think you get the sense that other people have been in this exact same position and they shouldn't have to be. I think that's clear. But, you know, when you're pulling a shotgun trigger against the head of a zombie, I don't think you put in much thought about that.
Interesting. Yeah. So maybe there is something to be said for guiding someone, or at least bringing it to their attention.
Yeah, that's true. So next on Jason's list is Chess Master, which is, you know, it's chess. But it's chess where your pieces kill each other in violent ways. It's very much like the Star Wars
Yeah, the space chess that Chewie and R2 were playing.
Yeah, and
but I mean, you know, Chris Baker submitted this to the list, and he just talks about it. He talks about chess generally as a game that is just about total war.
Yeah.
And again, this is, you know, it's tongue in cheek, but I was thinking about this in terms of some other types of games. I was listening to Michael Abbott on the Three Moves Ahead podcast, and they were talking about the ethics of strategy war games. And then it just struck me that in strategy games kind of get a pass because there's no explicit violence.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of body counts, a war sim can, you know, beat the most bloodthirsty first-person shooter.
Yeah, absolutely. And actually, in my opinion, those are one of the more dangerous set of games.
Mm-hmm.
When the lawyer in the Supreme Court case made the argument that, you know, what we are stopping is a deviant, he said, deviant level of violence, I think that you kind of ignore the fact that strategy games recreate certain ideological assumptions that may or may not justify and vindicate actual real-life warfare. People can internalize...
Like the level of abstraction?
Yeah, because, yeah, just, well, not just that. I mean, not just the fact that you aren't seeing the human face of combat. I mean, I suppose you could make that argument. But more so that there are certain assumptions built into the game mechanics about whether or not certain military actions are or are not effective.
So like bombing a city or something like that.
Yeah, like bombing a city or you know, even take Civilization, for example. In some cases, or in fact, I think in most, if not all, of the Civilization games, it's much easier to achieve a military victory than it is to achieve a diplomatic victory. The game mechanics of that game make that necessarily so, whereas reality and the international system might not make that necessarily so.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard because it's an institutional thing which doesn't have a very clean-cut human face that you can put on it.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't...
But it's still, you know, institutional violence.
Yeah, and I don't want to criticize strategy games for this because I don't think they also come to it, and even if they do, I certainly wouldn't be for banning these games.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
More so that the idea of what deviant is usually just based on really kind of clear-cut, essential, you know, gore and violence and sexual depravity, not, you know, not the more intricate aspects of violence.
Well, I guess we should move on to a very intricate, heady, ideological game about violence.
Yeah, Mortal Kombat. you know, this is funny because I don't think that Mortal Kombat really has anything to say politically or socially, you know, or scientifically. Well, you know, I guess it does have good physics. If you fall off a cliff,
some anatomy.
You will. Yeah, exactly. If you fall on spikes falling 30 feet, you will absolutely get punctured through the chest. That's just a fact. I would equate Mortal Kombat with Kill Bill. I think these are two kind of very artistic, very aesthetically designed experiences that are incredibly violent. But for
and that's
sake,
just it. The violence is the art in it.
Absolutely, yeah.
And it's a hard case to make because, again, you know, we're going back to the participatory aspect of it. You know, Kill Bill doesn't really allow the viewer to truly press the button, you know, when the bride is slicing up, you know, the crazy 88 or whatever.
Yeah, I guess. But, I mean, pressing the button and ripping someone's heart out of the chest are two very different things.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's definitely, it's a devil's advocate argument. It's also interesting to see Mortal Kombat come up over and over again through the years. It was one of the games that was instrumental in instituting the ESRB.
Yeah.
And as the years go on, it starts looking more and more quaint almost because it's so over the top. It's hard to conceive that we really were scared of it at a certain time.
Yeah. You were mentioning before the podcast that the game that they keep citing in the Supreme Court case is Postal or Postal 2.
Yeah.
Which you were saying yourself is really dated.
Yeah. Postal 2 was, I mean, it was not a good game when it came out. It is not a good game today. And not a lot of people even played it. I mean, it's not like, it doesn't have the cultural cachet of Mortal Kombat. And so it's, the case, another reason why I'm uncomfortable with the case is that it's taking these fringe games, these outliers, and trying to have a discussion about all of video games about on it.
Yeah.
You know, it'd be like asking whether we need to ban movies just by selecting Kill Bill and The Shining and, I don't know, whatever, however many other violent movies you want to list,
yeah.
as if they're representative of the medium and what it needs to be censored from.
So do you think that the lawyers would be making a better case if they chose games that were just over the border of too deviant and obscene?
I mean, if they were smart, I don't know. I guess I don't really know exactly how they want to structure the case, but I mean, like, if they were smart, they would be trying to show a pattern that the average game, the bulk of games released, are more focused on extreme violence than the bulk of other art, and are more easily wind up in the hands of children than the bulk of other artistic forms.
Yeah.
But I don't think anyone has the stamina nor the interest in really surveying every single game that's ever come out and trying to find some kind of pattern amongst them.
Well, while on the subject of the reach of certain games, the last game on the list is Grand Theft Auto 3, which undoubtedly was widely played, and people still play the Grand Theft Auto franchise, which really hasn't changed all that much from Grand Theft Auto 3. It still allows True. A small individual to go around a huge city and just kill people. You can, you know, have sex with prostitutes and then kill the prostitutes and ignore traffic yeah. signals and run over people and kill cops and all those things.
All of those things equivalently bad.
Yeah, well, I mean, yeah, I mean, ignoring traffic signals, that's just inhuman. But the series does, in my opinion, best represent what people are scared of, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. I think that the majority of parents who are scared about violent video games getting in the hands of their children will point at Grand Theft Auto and say, this is the game that everyone loves and I don't want my kid to be playing it.
That's true. And I mean, I think Grand Theft Auto is probably, I mean, I am most sympathetic to that argument with a game like Grand Theft Auto because it is so heavily marketed and, you know, it contains a lot of other things that are attractive to a certain age group. Like, they're always really careful about what kind of music they put in there.
Yeah.
You know, they're usually on the cutting edge in terms of visuals, which is, you know, really attractive. And, you know, it's hard. It's hard because I think those games are some of the most satirical games out there, and there's not a lot of satirical games. There's not a lot of like truly biting games about society, and I think GTA is one of the few series that does it well.
Yeah.
It's just too bad that people are focused on like the most inane parts of it.
Yeah, I mean, I would say Grand Theft Auto was hands down an adult game.
Yeah, yeah. Well, something that you have to like. You have to have lived in the world long enough to know how they're lampooning the world that they're creating.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I don't think I would let my children play this game.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's probably the right choice because you don't want to drop someone into that world without properly preparing them for it, I guess.
Yeah, I mean they allude to like police violence and stuff. Like, there's some, you know, you're teaching your kids in middle school like, oh, cops are who you go to trust and stuff, and then you see a game where they're just, you know, corrupt and shady and, you know, sling drugs and that kind of stuff.
But you don't necessarily want to block that from kids that can handle it, and I think that's the problem in this law in general. Like, by banning something, you're taking the decision out of the people's hands who have the most to gain and lose from it. I mean, if the kid is young enough, you know, the parent should be able to make that decision. And, you know, I don't know. I'm really sympathetic towards that stuff. I mean, like, personal anecdote, there was a time in grade school where we would go to the school library every week, and the librarian would forbid us from checking out books from a certain section. And that's where they would have, like, you know, the more normal books. Like, that's where Jurassic Park would be. That's where, you know, the adult books would be.
Yeah.
And it was really nice because when my dad learned about that, he, like, specifically wrote a note to the librarian saying that, you know, my son is allowed to check out any book in the library he wants.
Awesome.
Because, you know, I trust him. And you know, I was then able to read Jurassic Park, which is like a pretty, you know, it's a fairly violent Absolutely. Book. But I mean, again, like, I was old enough to make the decision that I wanted to do it. And my dad trusted me enough to let me do it. But, and that's the problem with the game law is that if you put it in the hands of the government, you know, no matter how many notes your dad writes, you're not going to be able to get it.
Yeah, yeah. Especially when, you know, when people in the industry are not sure whether or not they should even make those experiences, you know?
Yeah, then they might not even be able to get it when they are old enough or they are allowed to play it, which is, you know, something that you definitely don't want to happen.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I mean, even when I was young, my brother would take me out on political protests and teach me, you know, cops are not always distrustful, and I was maybe 12. So, yeah. You know, sometimes people think that getting those lessons are valuable. And if you think you can get your kid to learn a lesson from Grand Theft Auto, then go for it. I mean, and as it stands now, your kid's not supposed to be able to buy Grand Theft Auto from a GameStop anyway. You know, you're going to have to...
Yeah, that's the other thing. I mean, this can all be achieved through pressure on retailers if they were that serious about it. You know, there's no... The thing that always confuses me is that there's already a structure in place, and it's far easier to change the behavior of a store than it is to change the behavior of the Constitution. So I'm not sure appealing this all the way up to the highest court is necessarily the most expedient way to take care of the problem, which is a real problem. Like, I don't want kids playing Black Ops and they're 10 or something like that. I mean, I don't think that's appropriate, but
yeah, especially because they're going to kick my ass, you know? So,
but yeah, I mean, they're too twitchy. They know how to, they can learn the maps faster. Their brains are more malleable.
Yeah.
But I mean, you know, just complain to GameStop. Don't, you know, you don't have to, there's no need to fight this huge legal battle about it, in my opinion.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. But again, you know, this is coming out of legitimate concerns.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think people are quick to either retreat and say, oh, you know, they're just games, we don't need anything, or people are quick to go on the offensive, like, people should be able to play anything at all times, sell it all. But I mean, you know, there is a legitimate concern. It's just that, you know, the means are a little bit skewed, I think.
Yeah.
All right. Well, we've solved all the problems of the world.
We're done. I think we're going to become the next Supreme Court justices.
Oh, man. We probably wouldn't be able to podcast then. There'd probably be some conflict of interest thing.
Yeah.
All right. We'll have to graciously refuse. Sorry, Mr. Obama. If you folks want to write in with your thoughts on either the game bill or any of the games that we were talking about, feel free. Our email address is experiencepoints@gmail.com.
We also encourage you to leave your comments to this podcast or any of our posts. We update the site Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday evenings. And again, that is experiencepoints.blogspot.com. So come on down and bring your friends and a lawyer.
All right, until next time. Take it easy.